Some cases close with a confession, some close with a conviction, and some never really close at all. The Grimes Tapes is a detective fiction series following Detective Sarah Grimes as she works the cases that don't fit neatly into a file. Cases where power, politics, and human nature collide. And the truth is, the last thing anyone wants found. The Grimes Tapes, Season 2, Next of Kin, Episode 3, The Evidence Against. The DNA results come back. The case against Nate Brannick starts to crack. Grimes drives 2 hours to a dead man's house and finds the questions she should have been asking from the beginning. This is a work of fiction. All characters and events are imagined. The DNA results arrived on a Monday, which was fitting because Mondays were when the world handed you things you didn't want and expected gratitude. Dr. Pauline Aoki from the forensic lab called Grimes directly, which meant the results were either very good or very bad. And in homicide, the difference between those two things was usually a matter of perspective. "We got a profile from the material under the victim's fingernails," Aoki said. "YSTR analysis. The samples from the main room were too degraded. Your housekeeper did a number on them, but the tub area gave us enough to work with." "And?" "We ran it against the reference sample you submitted for Nathan Brannick." Grimes waited. Aoki was precise, and precise people didn't rush. "It's a match. The Y chromosome markers from the contributor are consistent with the reference sample, same paternal lineage." "Consistent with?" "YSTR doesn't give you a unique identification the way autosomal does. It tells you the contributor shares a paternal line with your reference. Father, son, brother, paternal uncle, anyone in the same male lineage would show the same profile." "So it could be Nate, or a paternal relative we don't know about, paternal uncle, a cousin, anyone in that line." "Technically, yes, but given the context, the victim is the father and the son is your suspect, the practical interpretation is clear. The blood under the victim's fingernails came from someone in Nathan Brannick's paternal line, and Nathan Brannick is the most likely candidate." Grimes heard what Aoki was saying. She also heard what Aoki wasn't saying, that YSTR was a family test, not an individual test, that it drew a circle around a bloodline rather than pointing a finger at a person. But that distinction evaporated in a squad room full of cops who wanted a collar. The squad room exhaled. That was the only way to describe it. The collective release of held breath, the settling of shoulders, the shared energy of a team that had been carrying a case and could now set it down. Callahan's face showed relief and something harder to name. Satisfaction, maybe. The validation of a theory he'd been building since day one. "DNA confirms," he said to the room. "Nathan Brannick's Y chromosome profile matches the blood found under the victim's fingernails." Nods. A few quiet goods. Somewhere, someone closed a file. The Dunmore delegation had been checking in daily, Garza by phone, Molina by unannounced visit, and when the DNA results leaked, which took approximately 4 hours because precincts were sieves, Molina called to say he'd known it all along, that the boy had always been troubled, that grief was no excuse. Grimes did not point out that Molina had known Thomas Brannick for 30 years and apparently never noticed that the man was hiding something massive enough to get him killed. The DA's office called that afternoon. ADA Rachel Domenici wanted to discuss charges. First-degree murder of a retired law enforcement officer carried weight, and the case was building. DNA, hotel identification, timeline, physical injuries consistent with the assault, prior arrest, resisting, assaulting an officer. Nate's public defender, a woman named Janet Okoye, who was simultaneously managing 17 other cases, had already started making plea noises. Grimes should have been satisfied. The evidence was there. The story made sense. Son and father fighting after the mother's death. Son drinking, angry, maybe driving to the hotel to confront the father who wouldn't talk to him. An argument that escalated. Two broken mirrors, a body in a bathtub, a son who ran. It was a clean story, and clean stories still made her skin itch. She started a list. Not in the case file, in her personal notebook, the one she kept in her jacket pocket, the one that smelled like coffee and bad decisions. Things that don't fit. 1. One-night stay. If Tom was meeting Nate, why a hotel? Nate has an apartment. Tom has a house 2 hours away. Why spend money on a room? 2. The missing phone. If Nate killed Tom in a rage, did he think to take the phone? Angry drunks don't strategize. They hit and they leave. 3. The untraceable calls. 3 calls to a burner phone. Who was Tom calling? Not Nate. Nate's number is in the record, too. 4. Something Claire left me. Tom was pulling old case files at the station, driving to the city without explanation, searching for something. What? 5. Room service. Tom ordered a hamburger and never ate it. He was killed within hours of checking in. The killer came fast, like someone who knew Tom was there. Someone who was expected. 6. The hotel ID. The bellhop said, could be, not that's him, not definitely, could be. She looked at the list. 6 items, 6 threads that didn't weave into the story everyone was telling. Callahan appeared at her desk. DA wants a timeline for charges. What do I tell them? Tell them I'm still building the file. The file's built, Grimes. DNA, ID, timeline, motive. What motive? He blinked. Grief, anger, father-son conflict. That's a motive for an argument. It's a motive for a fistfight, maybe. It's not a motive for beating a man to death in a bathtub. Nate Brannick is 23 years old with no violent history beyond a public intox and a scuffle during his arrest. You're telling me he walked into a hotel room and beat a retired cop, a man who spent 28 years restraining people for a living so badly that the man's face was unrecognizable? People snap. People snap, and when they do, there's a reason. The snap, I believe, the reason we don't have. Callahan's jaw did the thing it did when he was biting back words. You don't think it's him? I think we're not done. That afternoon, Grimes drove to Dunmore. 2 hours of highway and her own thoughts, which was the worst combination, but occasionally produced something useful. The drive was flat and gray, the kind of overcast that compressed everything to the same distance. Tom Brannick's house was a modest two-story with a flag bracket on the porch and a lawn that had been mowed by someone who cared about lines. The mail had been collected, Garza, probably, or one of the other Dunmore cops who'd decided custody of Tom's affairs was their birthright. Grimes had a warrant for Tom's personal effects. She started with his computer. The search history was a roadmap of obsession. Ancestry.com, FamilySearch.org, state adoption registries, birth records for 3 counties she'd never heard of. Searches for terms like private adoption Pennsylvania and how to find birth parents and sealed adoption records legal access. The searches had started 2 weeks after Claire's death and intensified steadily, sometimes 20 or 30 queries in a single day. Not typical grieving widower behavior. A second laptop sat on the kitchen table, older than Tom's, its casing scuffed and one corner duct taped where the plastic had cracked. Password protected. When she hit the spacebar, the screen lit up to a lock prompt. No hint, no username visible. Grimes bagged it. Whatever was on it could wait for the lab. In Tom's desk drawer, she found a legal pad with handwritten notes. Most of it was illegible. Tom's handwriting had the cramped urgency of a man writing faster than he could think. But fragments stood out. A case number from the state child welfare system, a phone number with a Whitfield area code, and at the top of the page, underlined twice, a single name, Ellis. Grimes stared at it. It meant nothing to her. A first name or a last name, a person or a place. It sat on the page like a door she didn't yet have the key for. She photographed the legal pad. She took the computer. She went out the back door to check the garage. Behind it, she found the burn barrel. It was a rusted 50-gallon drum, the kind people used for yard waste, and there'd been something in it recently. The ash was still dry inside. If it had rained since the burning, the residue would have clumped to gray mud, but this was powdery and light. She could see the shapes of burnt papers, curled and carbonized, and what might have been cloth, a piece at the rim, stiff and darkened, with a seam that suggested a sleeve or a collar. Not fall leaves, not yard waste. She photographed it from three angles, noted the date in her log, and scraped samples into an evidence bag. She stood there a moment. The cold had the particular stillness of a November afternoon when nothing is moving but you can feel the temperature changing. Someone had burned things here recently. Papers, clothing, maybe after the murder. The timeline fit. Nate was here before the trooper picked him up. She added it to the case file without comment. The evidence was what it was. Back in the car, heading west, Grimes submitted two requests over her phone. The first was for Claire Brannick's employment records, social worker, 30-plus years, state child welfare system. The bureaucracy would take time. She requested it as connected to an active homicide investigation. The second was for cell tower data on Tom's missing phone. If the phone had been powered on after the murder, the towers would have tracked its movement. Long shot, but she'd asked for it before the carriers had time to cycle their logs. She drove. Back at the precinct, she found Callahan at his desk with the settled look of a man working toward a conclusion he already knew. The second DNA test was the conversation she'd been building toward for 2 days. Order a second DNA test. He looked up. The DNA matched. The YSTR matched. I want a full autosomal profile. Different lab, different analyst, complete workup. Why? Because the YSTR tells us family line, not individual. Because our case needs to be airtight if it goes to trial. And because you want this to stick, Callahan, I can see it in your face. You want this kid nailed to the wall. So give me the test that nails him. A full autosomal match is individual identification. It's the difference between could be and is. She'd framed it as his desire, which was close enough. Callahan wanted the certainty. He wanted the case locked down, the lid sealed, the Dunmore cops satisfied, the Brotherhood appeased. He wanted the second test to bury Nathan Brannick. He ordered the test. Grimes went back to her desk and stared at the photograph of Tom's legal pad. The second laptop, bagged and awaiting analysis. The burn barrel, photographed and logged. The name at the top of the page, Ellis. She added it to the list as number 7. Nate had been formally charged on a Thursday morning, in a courtroom with fluorescent lights that hummed at a different frequency than his cell, before a judge with a face like a closed book. The words were read to him in a register that was somehow both loud and completely inert. They filled the room without landing anywhere. First-degree murder, in the death of Thomas Michael Brannick. Janet Okoye entered the not guilty plea with the practiced ease of a woman who had done this 1,000 times. She was in her mid-30s, overworked, carrying a stack of folders that represented 17 other people's catastrophes. She was not unkind, but she was not his. Before the courtroom, there had been the processing. This part Nate understood now in a way he hadn't understood anything for a long time. The understanding of a body that had been put through a procedure. Strip search. The folded pile of his own clothes placed in a clear plastic bag, sealed, labeled with a number. The inventory read aloud, wallet, $11 and change, a key ring, a phone charger, a receipt from a gas station dated the week before any of this happened, and a photograph, Claire holding him as a baby, both of them squinting against the sun, her face radiant in the way it got when she was thinking about something else and didn't know anyone was watching. The officer with the clipboard wrote it down as photo, personal. Nate watched it go into the bag. He didn't ask to keep it. He already understood, from someplace below language, that asking for things would not produce them. The uniform was orange. The cell was 7x10. He paced it the first day, 4 steps one way, 3 the other, turn, repeat. And then he stopped pacing because pacing used the same energy as everything else, and everything else was just waiting. The light was always on. Not bright, exactly, more like the minimum amount of light that would qualify as light. It flattened the room into a single shade of institutional nothing, and it never changed, so after a while your body couldn't locate itself in time. He slept in pieces and woke up not knowing whether it was morning or afternoon, and it didn't matter because the cell looked the same regardless. Janet came twice a week. She brought folders, coffee for herself, updates that weren't updates. The DNA, as she explained it in their third meeting, was not a unique match. YSTR, she said, family lineage, not individual identification. Any male relative on Nate's father's side would show the same markers.
I told you, Dad didn't have male relatives. He had a brother who died before I was born, that's it.
So the prosecution will argue there's no one else it could be. He understood each piece she gave him. The cab records putting him at the hotel, his own statement placing him on the sidewalk outside, Devin Carter's could be, the timeline, his arrest injuries, his prior, his disappearance after the body was found, and the DNA, which wasn't proof of him specifically, but was proof enough of his family, which in practice meant him. He understood each piece. He couldn't argue any of them. The plea conversation happened in the fourth meeting. Nate had started counting meetings as a way of counting weeks. Janet set down her coffee. She smoothed the top folder on the stack and didn't open it. Nate, I have to walk you through the landscape. The DA is going to offer a deal. Given the evidence, given the charges, given the victim being a retired police officer, they're looking at manslaughter or second degree in exchange for a plea. If this goes to trial with what we have right now, you're looking at first degree murder. Possible life sentence.
You're telling me to plead guilty.
I'm telling you what the landscape looks like.
I didn't do this.
Janet looked at him. She had the kind of eyes that had stopped being surprised by anything long before they'd met. But there was something in them that might have been belief, or might have been the professional obligation to behave as though she believed. He couldn't tell the difference anymore.
I hear you.
I didn't even know he was at a hotel. That was the part he kept coming back to, the part that didn't make any sense to him regardless of everything else. He called me the day before and said he was coming to town and we'd have dinner. That was it. I thought he was going to call when he got in. I was waiting. I had 3 drinks on the couch waiting for him to call. He stopped. Why was he at a hotel? He could have stayed with me. I've got a couch. Or he could have gotten dinner and driven back. It's 2 hours, not the moon. Why did he book a room? That's a question for the investigation.
The investigation thinks I did it.
What I mean is, the investigation will establish his reason for being there.
His reason for being there got him killed, and I still don't know what it was. I don't know who he was meeting. I don't know why he didn't call me after he checked in. I don't know why he didn't.
I was right there. I was outside the building. He heard how that sounded. He'd heard how it sounded every time he said it for 2 weeks now, and it still sounded the same.
I didn't go in.
The bellhop said could be. That's not me. The bellhop will say it on the stand, and the jury will hear it alongside the cab record and the DNA and your injuries and your prior arrest. And what juries do is add things up, Nate. They don't parse testimony. They add it up and they come to the answer it points to.
I didn't do it.
He said it again, the way he'd been saying it, the way he'd been saying it to Janet and to the detective and to the troopers on the road who hadn't cared. And the repetition had done something strange to the words. They still felt true, but they had started to feel like something other than an argument. More like something that had stopped being an argument and started being just a fact about himself. True, but not the kind of thing a courtroom cared about. Janet waited. She was good at waiting.
She had to be. What happens to him? Nate asked. The person who actually did this. If I take the deal, what happens to whoever actually killed my father?
If you take the deal, the case is closed.
He put his hands flat on the table. They were his father's hands, or he'd always thought so. Long fingers, big knuckles. Claire used to say he had a piano player's hands. God only knew where he got them, because nobody in either family had ever touched an instrument.
She'd said it lightly. He'd never thought to ask why the observation had that extra weight underneath it. The kind words have when the person saying them knows something they're not saying.
I didn't do it, he said, once more. Not at Janet, just into the room. And then silence, because there was nothing else to say and the words had been worn to a thread by their own repetition, and somewhere in the city his father's killer was still alive and nobody was looking for him. Janet gathered her folders. She would come back. She would bring more updates. The system would continue to process him through its stages. In his cell that night, Nate lay on the cot with the light humming above him and ran the numbers one more time. The cab, the sidewalk, the hotel entrance he hadn't walked through, the lamplighter, McCaffrey's, the curb, the booking room, the road to Dunmore, the burn barrel, that one he understood now from reading between the lines of what Janet said and didn't say. That one they knew about. That one was him, and he couldn't explain it except to say that the anger had been a living thing, and the papers had been there, and he'd done it, and he hadn't understood yet what he was doing, what kind of world he was standing in. He tried to make the pieces add up to something other than what they added up to. He couldn't. He stopped trying and stared at the ceiling and waited for morning, which looked the same as night.